Hello, folks. This is Peggy Garvey McMahon, your volunteer reader for Sun Sounds. I hope everybody had a nice Thanksgiving and you're ready to sit back, relax, and enjoy this week's Time Magazine. We have week two of the biweekly issue, and I'll be reading you the brief and the view. Our first article in the brief is Voters Push Back. In Virginia and elsewhere, Donald Trump's erratic economic policies spurred a backlash. This is by Brian Bennett. After a year in the political wilderness, Democrats rode frustration over high prices and President Donald Trump's disruptive economic policies to win a raft of elections in the country on November 4th. In Virginia and New Jersey, voters handed the party the keys to the governor's mansions by larger-than-expected margins. In California, voters overwhelmingly approved new congressional districts to benefit Democrats after Texas passed its own new map to favor the GOP. But it was a series of decisive victories in down-ballot races that Republican incumbents that stunned leaders in both parties and bolstered Democrats' hopes that they had landed on a viable playbook for next year and the midterm elections. Pennsylvania voted to keep three justices backed by Democrats on the state Supreme Court. Democrats in Georgia won two utility commission seats by double digits, the widest margins that Democrats have seen in statewide contests there in two decades. In Mississippi, where absentee ballots were still being counted days later, Democrats appeared poised to flip two seats in the state Senate, breaking a GOP supermajority. In the wake of months of polls showing much of the electorate was dissatisfied with both parties, the initial response from many Democrats as running the table in such a hodgepodge of contests was a mixture of jubilation and disbelief. Democratic National Committee Chair Kenneth Martin says the Democrats are now full steam ahead to take back the Congress next year as the party of affordability. Republicans are scrambling to chart their own path forward. The party has just a year to show that it's making a difference on the issues that the electorate cares about most, says Whit Ayers, a longtime GOP strategist. He called the margins of victory that voters gave to governors and governor-elect Abigail Spangenberger in Virginia and Mikey Sherrill in New Jersey pretty remarkable, and the Republican losses in Mississippi and Georgia concerning. The less visible races are as much of a concern as the most visible ones, Ayers said. Democrats are giving a particularly close look to the upset in Georgia, where they managed to flip two seats on the Georgia Public Service Commission, which oversees the Georgia Power Company. Democrats Peter Hubbard and Alicia Johnson both won with more than 60% of the vote. Party leaders see the results as a sign that the cost of utility has emerged as one of the most salient issues for voters. According to the United States Energy Information Administration, home electricity bills rose 6.1% from August 2024 to August 2025. But a widespread Trump backlash is also part of the story. Exit polling suggests that Trump dragged down Republicans in multiple races. In New Jersey, 97% of voters who voted for Sherrill said their vote was to oppose Trump, according to NBC exit polling. A year after Kamala Harris carried the state by 6 points, Sherrill won it by 13. Trump had some excuses for the GOP's poor performance, including the fallout from a government shutdown, that his party has tried to blame entirely on Democrats. The shutdown was a big factor, Trump told GOP senators at the White House the morning after. I don't think it was good for Republicans. Trump himself decided not to campaign in person in Virginia or New Jersey. Vice President J.D. Vance posted on X that it's idiotic to overreact to a couple of elections, but acknowledged that the Democrats' focus on the cost of living broke through with voters. He argued that Trump's policies had helped lower interest rates and inflation, and that making a decent life affordable is the metric by which we'll ultimately be judged in 2026 and beyond. But the other GOP strategy appears to be tying Democrats to Zoran Mamdani, the Democratic Socialist set to be New York City's next mayor. Mamdani drew more than a million votes in a campaign focused on hiking taxes on the wealthy to pay to make childcare, rent, and transportation more affordable. In the run-up to the election, some Democrats held Mamdani at arm's length. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, a New York City resident, refused to say whom he voted for in the race. Republicans insist that Mamdani is a warning sign that Democrats are veering further to the left. Working families watching this play out have a right to know that socialism and communism are not just confined to New York City, House Speaker Mike Johnson told reporters on the steps of the Capitol the morning after Mamdani's win. They are quickly coming into a town near you unless you stand up and let your voice of common sense be heard. But Democratic leaders say that the results show them that the party does best when candidates reflect the local electorate, pointing to the moderate campaigns of Spangenberger and Sherrill. In her victory speech, as Virginia's first woman elected governor, Spangenberger delivered lines that Democrats will likely echo over the next 12 months. "We choose our commonwealth over chaos," Spangenberger said. "You all choose leadership that will focus relentlessly on what matters most, lowering costs, keeping our communities safe, and strengthening our economy. For every Virginian, leadership that will focus on the problems and the problem solving, not on stoking division." Our next article in this week's brief is the bulletin, and the title is "Fears of a New Genocide as Darfur Burns Again." Darfur has once more become the center of a violence in Sudan's brutal civil war, sparking warnings of a repeat of the genocide that blighted the region two decades ago. After a suffocating 18-month siege that had trapped tens of thousands of people and caused widespread hunger, the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, RSF, captured El Fasher on October 26th. The city was the last holdout in the region of the Sudanese armed forces, which had been fighting the RSF for the past 3 years. Martha Ama Akaya Pobi, the Assistant Secretary General of the UN for Africa, told the Security Council on October 30th that the fall of El Fasher marked a significant shift in the security dynamics of Sudan, warning that the territorial scope of the conflict is broadening. Reports of massacres, executions, and sexual violence carried out by the RSF soon followed as thousands attempted to flee the city. Graphic images of those atrocities circulated on social media as the paramilitary group, a descendant of the same Arab militias implicated in what the U.S. termed genocide in Darfur 2 decades ago, carried out ethnically targeted massacres. It was like a killing field, Tajla Rahman, the man in his late 50s, told the Associated Press. Bodies everywhere, and people bleeding, and no one came to help them. One of the worst incidents took place in the Saudi hospital, the last medical facility operating in the city, where some 460 people were killed in several waves of attacks, according to the World Health Organization. The UN estimated more than 70,000 people fled El-Fasher in the week after it fell, but only a fraction of that number, 5,000, had arrived in the nearest city, Tawila, 37 miles away, during the same period. Where are all of the missing people? Michael Oliver Lachette, head of the emergency at Medicine Sans Frontiers, MSF, Doctors Without Borders, asked as reports of mass killings proliferated. Based on what patients tell us, most likely, albeit frightening, the answer is that they are being killed, blocked, and hunted down when they're trying to flee, Doctors Without Borders said. And many who made it to Tawila were severely malnourished and reported torture and sexual violence along the way. On November 3rd, the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, IPC, declared famine in El-Fasher and the town of Kajuli in South Kordofan province, which is also under siege by the RSF. Famine has been declared in 5 other places in Sudan since the war began in April of 2023. The IPC said 20 other areas in Kordofan and Darfur are also at risk. And this is by Rebecca Schneid and Richard Hall. Next is the Good Question article in this week's The Brief. And the question is the NFL safer than high school football? Scientists are starting to better understand the degenerative brain disease, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, CTE. Even more athletes say that they believe that they have it. What causes CTE, says Dr. Daniel Daneshwar, chief of the Division of Brain Injury Rehabilitation at Harvard Medical School, is the cumulative force that a person gets exposed to, perhaps most infamously on, say, a football field. Because CTE is caused by cumulative head impacts and not just one big blow, people who start playing football as kids, even those who may not play past high school, can end up with CTE. But while the NFL has made some changes to try and help players avoid repeated head impacts, advocates point out that the groups that operate organized football for younger players have done relatively little. Everybody in football is aware of what the NFL has done and has made an active choice not to follow, says Chris Nowinski, as CEO and co-founder of the Concussion Legacy Foundation, who has been talking for years about the need to better protect athletes of all ages from CTE. It's just a dramatic failure of leadership. Indeed, in 2016, NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell acknowledged that football-related head trauma was linked to brain disease, a big step for a league that had been reluctant to admit any connection. Since then, the NFL has prohibited tackling during off-season practices and in early stages of preseason, reduced the length of overtime in the preseason, regular season, and banned players from lowering their heads to make contact with an opponent using their helmet. Perhaps most importantly, the NFL significantly changed the kickoff in the 2024 season, moving teams closer together to limit how fast players ran at one another. The changes appear to be reducing concussions. Recorded concussions decreased by 17% in 2024, the year that the new kickoff rules went into place, compared with those in 2023. A few college, high school, or youth leagues have made similar changes on how the game is played, or even acknowledged the connection between the game and CTE. The NCAA, for example, still allows a relatively high number of live contact practices, those in which players wear full pads and practice tackling and blocking. After a few days of acclimatization in the preseason, schools are allowed to have 8 full contact practices, and they are allowed to practice tackling and blocking for as long as 75 minutes in each practice. The NCAA, which declined to comment for this story, has also adopted the NFL's kickoff changes. High school football has done even less. In 2014, the National Federation of State High School Associations, NFHS, issued a recommendation for minimizing head impact exposure and concussions in football that included limiting full contact practice to the regular season and limiting contact in practices. But the recommendations still allowed full contact practices 2 to 3 times a week for up to 90 minutes per week. Carissa Niehoff, CEO of NFHS, wrote in a 2019 blog post that there was no link between CTE and playing high school football. She says she still believes that today, and that there's no way for researchers to disentangle the possible effects of playing other sports when they study the question. Youth football may be the least regulated of all. It's easy to find TikTok videos of young kids running in the Oklahoma drill or the Bull in the Ring drill, both of which pit 2 players against each other in close contact. Both lead to high incidents of injury and are not allowed at the professional level. The best strategy to protect youth, Nowinski and other experts say, is to set minimum ages for the most dangerous activities, like tackling. In 2011, USA Hockey banned body checking in the 12 and under leagues, and in 2016, U.S. club soccer banned heading for players under 12. There seems to be little interest on banning tackling in football for kids under 12, though, Nowinski says. In 2023, the Concussion Legacy Foundation worked with legislators in California on a bill banning tackle football for children under 12. The bill had the support of legislators, but in January 2024, Governor Gavin Newsom, citing parents' rights, vowed that he would not sign it. If California doesn't pass such a bill, Nowinski says, it's likely that no other state will. Next in the brief are the milestones for this week, and our first one is Dick Cheney, who died, an American agent. In a half century of navigating the heights of U.S. executive power, Dick Cheney went from being widely admired as the competent public servant overseeing the United States' victory in the first Gulf War to profoundly polarizing, albeit in ways that might now make many wishful, the divisions that Cheney inveigled were grounded not in personal aggrandizement, but in differing concepts of duty to nation. His legacy, at the time of his death on November 3rd at 84, was as the most powerful U.S. vice president in history, who after 9/11 intrigued for the CIA to use torture for the National Security Agency to scoop up the communications of every American and for the invasion of Iraq, which killed hundreds of thousands, shifted the balance of regional power in Iran, and ultimately expanded the terrorist threat. Cheney mined the powers of his office so effectively that in the first term of President George W. Bush, he was described as regent, the nominal subordinate who wields the real power over a boy king. His reputation for stealth and rigidity gratified conservatives, and in liberal circles sketched a caricature of villainy laid on thick in Vice, a 2015 feature film that portrayed Cheney as a henpecked bumpkin who, a few scenes later, has become a diabolical mastermind. No other American politician in recent history moved so swiftly from light to shadow without the accelerant of personal scandal. He would run the gauntlet of being the toast of America after the Gulf War, and then being the monstrous, hideous person this warmonger torturer blow up the world in his late friend and former Senator Al Simpson told Time in 2021. Cheney embraced the notoriety, joking in speeches about his reputation as Darth Vader and dressing his black Labrador for Halloween as the Dark Lord of the Sith. The reputation distracted from Cheney's failure, as the official Bush had placed in charge of terrorism to heed warnings about 9/11. But he preferred working in the shadow, eyebrow cocked in meetings where he maintained a sphinx-like silence. In a capital where information is power, Cheney warned subordinates not to characterize his views to outsiders while manipulating the processes of a federal government that he had learned from the inside out. His Secret Service code name was Angler. Cheney physically embodied both prudence and paranoia. In 2007, the Wi-Fi was disabled in his cardiac defibrillator, lest a malign actor induce cardiac arrest in the man a heartbeat from the presidency. When President Trump was conniving to remain in office after losing the 2020 election, Cheney organized a letter of warning signed by all 10 living former defense secretaries, advocating all the more effective coming from a former public servant himself, who had become synonymous with a maximalist position of presidential power. And this is by Carl Vick. Next in milestones, we have blocked the Trump administration from mandating that people provide proof of citizenship on federal voter registration forms by a federal judge in Washington on October 31st. And then we have arrested three of the four suspects who the police believe were directly involved in the October 19th heist at the Louvre. The $100 million worth of jewelry stolen from the Paris Museum is still unaccounted for. And finally, in milestones, we have announced her retirement from Congress in 2027 by Nancy Pelosi on November 6th. The California Democrat has served in Congress for 38 years and was the first and only female Speaker of the House. Next in the brief, we have time with Wikipedia founder Jimmy Wales on rebuilding trust online and off. This is by Harry Booth. Jimmy Wales describes himself as a pathological optimist. And yet, when the co-founder of Wikipedia spoke with Time in October, he still seemed somewhat surprised that his online encyclopedia actually worked. Wikipedia is very trusting in a way that always seemed a bit crazy, Wales says. If you think about the chaos of social media, Wikipedia's model of allowing anyone to edit any entry seems completely insane, he says. We're speaking because Wales just penned his first book, The Seven Rules of Trust, which tries to describe what Wikipedia and a few other bright corners of the internet, Wales cites Airbnb, Uber, and eBay, can teach us about rebuilding trust in a world awash in skepticism. Since Wikipedia's launch in 2001, trust in politicians, mainstream media, and, to some extent, each other, has all plummeted, Wales says, with consequences extending beyond political deadlocks. Wales, 59, was friends with Joe Cox, the British Labour Member of Parliament who was murdered in 2016 by a far-right extremist days before the Brexit referendum. He believes that the rise of politically motivated violence is a natural result of this feeling of a complete breakdown of societal norms and of the idea of trust, being able to say, look, I disagree with you, but I trust that we can have a dialogue and we'll find a compromise and we can move forward, he says. And yet, Wikipedia has gone from being kind of a joke to one of the few things that people trust. Lately, though, that breakdown of trust has started nipping at Wikipedia's heels. Billionaire Elon Musk, who was once a big fan of Wikipedia, has turned on the encyclopedia, as has White House AI and crypto czar David Sacks, conservative commentator Tucker Carlson, and even Wales' estranged co-founder Larry Sanger, who have all claimed Wikipedia is biased. In October, the day before Wales published his book, Musk released a Wikipedia rival called Grokopedia, which he says uses his AI chat box, Grok, to generate entries. Currently, the AI-driven encyclopedia has more than 885,000 articles, many of which appear very similar to their Wikipedia counterparts. Well, Grokopedia is dwarfed by Wikipedia's more than 7 million English language articles. Musk said in a post on his social media platform X that Grokopedia will exceed Wikipedia by several orders of magnitude in breadth, depth, and accuracy. Musk has been critical of Wikipedia for some time, calling it Wokepedia, and in 2023 offering to give the platform, which is overseen by the nonprofit Wikimedia Foundation, $1 billion if he could rename it Dickopedia. Early responses to Grokopedia have split along familiar lines. Musk fans have lauded Grokopedia for having no human bias and no errors, and for its nuance and details in entries on topics like George Floyd's death. Grokopedia's article foregrounds Floyd's criminal record in its opening lines, mentioning his murder by a police officer only later. Critics, meanwhile, note that articles about Musk and his companies are longer than their Wikipedia counterparts, yet omit unflattering details. Unlike Wikipedia, Grokopedia can't be directly edited by users. They can inspect the sources and submit correction suggestions, but these aren't debated on public talk pages or decided by human moderators the way Wikipedia's are. They are instead processed by Grok, a version of the same AI chatbot that made anti-Semitic statements after an update in July, forcing XAI to apologize and deactivate the update. Wales's response to Musk? He told Bloomberg in October, "If you feel like Wikipedia has got some bias, encourage people to come and participate. People who agree with you. Don't paint us as crazy left-wing activists or something. We aren't." Wales seems keenly aware of Wikipedia's shortcomings. His book revisits infamous episodes like when an online troll used the site to falsely implicate journalist John Siegenthaler in the Kennedy assassinations. Wales writes that governments, activists, and ideologues have sought to use the platform's editing tools to push their worldview. But the site's continued growth suggests that these interests haven't won out over the voluntary army of Wikipedians, he says. The fact that Wikipedia is still massive, more popular than any newspaper, is partly because we try really hard, not perfect for sure, to stick to the facts and give transparency. Wales says you can see where information came from. You can click on it and check. Wales himself waded into an editing conflict over the site's entry titled Gaza Genocide on November 2nd, writing on a page for discussing edits that the article fails to meet our high standards for stating in Wikipedia's voice that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza. He called it a particularly egregious example of the site's broader neutrality issues. Wales's comments prompted pushback from some editors. Why should the opinions of the largely impartial UN and human rights scholars be weighed equally to the obviously partisan opinions of commentators and governments? One commentator asked. Because that's what neutrality demands, Wales responded. Our job as Wikipedians is not to take sides in that debate, but to carefully and neutrally document it. The Wikimedia Foundation said in a statement that even as co-founder, Wales is just one of hundreds of thousands of editors striving to present information, including on contentious topics, in line with Wikipedia's policies. Grokopedia isn't the only AI-driven threat to Wikipedia. Some 65% of the nonprofit's most server-straining traffic now comes from bots, some of which scrape the site to feed into chatbots for training. Instead of clicking through to Wikipedia, search engine users can now often find their answers in, sometimes wrong, AI-generated summaries. That's if they don't go straight to ChatGPT or Claude. Wales says that all of this means islands of human-generated content like Wikipedia becomes more important than ever. He says his principles of trust, just as relevant to AI developers, because every time you get an AI answer and find out that the AI hallucinated and just made that up, it reduces your trust. That's where the real world comes in. Part of Wales's pitch is that most of us already practice trust in very routine ways, such as getting into a rideshare or sharing an elevator with strangers. He points to Braver Angels, a U.S. group that hosts in-person conversations between people with opposing politics. Participants often emerge a little more understanding, a little more ready to think about compromise, Wales says. The challenge is designing institutions and online spaces that tap into those impulses. Wikipedia's collaborative culture, at its best, is a web version of that slow, structured, and imperfect. And for internet interactions, Wales' best advice is disarmingly simple. Direct your attention toward activities that build trust. Audit your feeds. If you find yourself spending too much time using social media and being fed information that you don't trust, then stop doing that, he says. He offers one specific nudge. Delete X from your phone. Continuing with the brief, we now have the health article, which is Five Phrases That Drive Therapists Up a Wall. This is by Angela Haupt. A therapist's job is to listen, but not all words are music to their ears. Some indicate that clients aren't taking the process seriously. Others reveal misunderstandings that need to be clarified or deep-rooted beliefs that should be corrected. We asked a handful of therapists which phrases drive them up a wall and why. Number one, I don't want to take up too much time. Apologizing for being in therapy just wastes precious time, says Lauren Auer, a therapist in Peoria, Illinois. It's literally my job, she says, yet she ends up needing to devote part of the session to convincing her clients that they deserve to be there. There may be underlying beliefs about worthiness at play. A lot of times, it's rooted in what they've learned about taking up space or being too much, Auer says. She often responds gently, let's talk about that. What I'm hearing from you is... And number two, sorry about crying. Uttering these words is like apologizing for breathing in my office, Auer says. Yet she hears them daily. She typically reminds clients that crying is actually really healthy, and it means they're feeling safe enough to let their guard down, which is a good sign of healing. When someone clearly feels bad about all the waterworks, Auer smiles and says, hey, no, crying is allowed in therapy, in a way that makes it clear she's joking. It usually gets a laugh, and that can break the shame spiral, she says. It helps them realize how ridiculous it sounds to apologize for crying in therapy. What should I do? It's a common question for people who want guidance, but therapists have absolutely no idea. And we're not supposed to know what you should do, says Nicole Herway, a therapist in Murray, Utah. We're here to empower you to make decisions for yourself, to try things and fail, to learn and grow. A better way of phrasing things, Herway adds, is to ask your therapist, can you help me consider some options? Therapy has never worked for me. Clients often ask Lisa shows to make promises or guarantees about therapeutic outcomes. They might add that therapy has never worked for them in the past, so why would it this time? They're trying to hook me into saying, well, this therapy will work for you, says Shows, a licensed professional counselor in Flagstaff, Arizona. I absolutely want it to work, and I also want to instill hope that it can work. But at the same time, I can't promise that it's going to be the thing that suddenly is helpful. Therapy is a collaborative relationship, she adds, that requires engagement and work on both parties' part to be successful. I'm just going to take this call real quick. You might be surprised how often clients check their phone throughout sessions, texting or taking non-emergency calls. They'll be a little preoccupied with it and getting notification after notification, and even if they have it on the chair, I can hear it buzzing, Sho says. Ideally, clients will silence their device and drop it into their bag, Sho says, so it's there if they need, but that way they're not distracted and are able to give themselves the space to do something a little different than we do the rest of our lives, she says. Folks, you're listening to Sun Sounds. This is week two of Time Magazine. We're reading The Brief and The View. We've just completed The Brief, and we're moving now into the articles in The View section. And our first one is the technology article, The AI Ban That We Need. This is by Andrea Miotti. No one knows how to control AIs that are vastly more competent than any human. Yet we are getting closer and closer to developing them, with many experts expecting superintelligence in the next 5 years at the current pace. This is why leading AI scientists warn that developing superintelligence AI that outperforms humans across all cognitive tasks could result in humanity's extinction. Tech companies are pouring billions of dollars into reaching superintelligence as fast as possible. Once we develop machines significantly more competent than us across all domains, we will most likely be at the mercy of the superintelligent machines themselves, as currently no country, no company, and no person knows how to control them. In theory, a superintelligent AI would pursue its own goals, and if those goals were incompatible with sustaining human life, we would be annihilated. To make matters worse, AI developers do not understand the current powerful AI systems actually at work. Unlike bridges or power plants, which are designed to precise human specifications, today's AI systems are grown from vast data sets through processes their own creators cannot interpret. Even Anthropic CEO Dario Amodei admits that we only understand 3% of how they work. Despite this danger, superintelligence remains the goal of leading AI companies. OpenAI, Anthropic, Google DeepMind, Meta, xAI, DeepSeek, and given the skyrocketing valuation of these companies, they are not about to stop by themselves. A coalition of scientific, religious, and political leaders are calling for a global prohibition on developing superintelligence. I was one of the early signatories to the petition, alongside Nobel laureates like Geoffrey Hinton, the world's most cited AI scientist, Yoshua Bengio, former advisor to President Donald Trump, Stephen Bannon, former Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Mike Mullen, and Prince Harry and Meghan, Duchess of Sussex. Governments worldwide must step in before it is too late. Yet the international situation is not encouraging. We live in an era of rising geopolitical tension. Countries are rushing to invest billions in data centers to power AI at a time when developing and deploying dangerous AI systems remains less regulated than opening a new restaurant or building a house. In this climate, is an international ban on the development of superintelligence even possible? Yes, because we've achieved such global prohibitions before. In 1985, the world learned there was a hole in the ozone layer above Antarctica. The culprits were chlorofluorocarbons, CFCs, ubiquitous industrial chemicals. Unless something was done, the hole would keep growing and millions of people would get skin cancer or go blind because of the lack of UV protection. Instead, millions banded together to ban CFCs. Scientists made the threat tangible with colored satellite pictures and clear discussion of the health consequences. NGOs orchestrated boycotts of huge brands and directed concerned citizens to write protest letters. Schools worldwide ran educational programs, and the UN endorsed public awareness campaigns. In 1987, a mere 2 years after the ozone hole was made public, every existing country signed the Montreal Protocol. Signed during the Cold War demonstrates it's possible to quickly reach decisive international agreement amid geopolitical tensions. One key factor was that the ozone hole endangered nearly everybody in the world. Superintelligence is a similarly universal threat. Loss of control of AI means that even those who develop it will not be spared from its dangers. The extinction risk has potential to cut through every division. It can unite people across political parties, religions, nations, and ideologies. Nobody wants their life, their family, or their world to be destroyed. As with the ozone hole, worry must be catalyzed into civic engagement, building a global movement that works with the governments to make a prohibition of superintelligence a reality. Unfortunately, most lawmakers simply still do not know about the threat of superintelligence or its urgency, and AI companies are now deploying hundreds of millions of dollars to crush attempts to regulate AI. The best counterbalance to this gargantuan lobbying effort is for lawmakers to hear from their constituents what they truly think about superintelligence. Very often, lawmakers will find that most of their constituents want them to say no to superintelligence and yes to a future where humanity survives and thrives. We know the movement to avoid this fate can be built. The question is, can we build it fast enough? Continuing now with articles in The View, our next one is the Weekly Risk Report. This is by Ian Bremmer, and it is, signals are growing louder that United States President Donald Trump wants Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro out of office. He'd like to accomplish this without starting a war, but that might not go to plan. So far, United States military actions against Venezuela have been limited to strikes against more than a dozen boats that the White House insists are carrying narcotics toward the United States. Drugs that Trump said in a November 2nd interview on 60 Minutes that are destroying families all over our country. Asked if that meant war, Trump said, "I don't think so, but they've been treating us very badly." At least 64 people have reportedly been killed by United States strikes on boats in the Caribbean and Eastern Pacific in recent weeks. The United States has now moved significant military hardware into position in the Caribbean, deploying an aircraft carrier group and placing significant naval strike capability and United States troops just off Venezuela's coast. The next United States step could be to hit targets inside Venezuela that the Trump administration insists fuel the drug trade. I'm not going to tell you what I'm going to do with Venezuela, if I was going to do it or if I wasn't going to do it," Trump said in the same 60 Minutes interview. In addition, United States officials reportedly told the New York Times last month that the Trump administration had secretly authorized the CIA to conduct covert action in Venezuela. Although Venezuela plays a minor role in the trafficking of drugs that reach the United States, a hard line against Caracas appeals to Trump's MAGA base and Latino backers who think the United States is too soft on Latin American leftists like Maduro, who has been in power since the death of Hugo Chavez in 2013 and is accused of stealing the 2024 election. Enter the growing United States pressure, which appears aimed at persuading Maduro's inner circle that the cost of continued loyalty to Venezuela's strongman has become too high and that he should be removed from within to avoid military escalation. If these tactics fail, the Trump administration might target Maduro directly. A move against Maduro from within Venezuela's security services would probably lead to United States-Venezuelan negotiations that allow a member of Maduro's team to replace him. A new president from within the armed forces might mend fences with Washington. In a less likely scenario, given deep military mistrust of the opposition, some segments of the military could side with the opposition leaders Maria Corina Machado and Edmundo Gonzalez, or push for fresh elections. But dealing with Maduro's men remains the only way to avoid war. The ruling United Socialist Party of Venezuela controls all of the country's powerful institutions, including state-run oil company Petróleos de Venezuela, S.A., the regime's cash cow. To cut Maduro loose, the security services would demand guarantees that their safety and control of the country's power and access to wealth would be protected, likely with international mediation that makes Trump administration commitments more credible. Yet, senior Venezuelan military leaders know that Maduro uses Cuban intelligence to spy on his own generals and that any move against their president risks execution. To persuade them to move, the United States could also directly get senior members of the regime, like Interior Minister Diosdado Cabello, for whom there is an outstanding $25 million United States reward, to press others to act. Trump knows that failure to remove Maduro could prove humiliating. And if Maduro is removed by direct United States military action, the situation inside Venezuela could quickly spiral out of control, forcing the United States president into decisions he'd rather avoid. Widespread social unrest could cost Trump the ability to influence who's in charge in Caracas, and assuming deep reluctance in the White House to put American troops in harm's way to keep order, could leave Trump responsible for an ensuing bloodbath as Venezuela's army and security services fight to contain the risk of civil war. The United States will make the final call, and while the appearance supportive of an escalating pressure campaign, there's no indication that he has settled on a singular strategy to get what he wants. And folks, that does it for Time Magazine today. I hope you've enjoyed hearing about what's happening. This is Peggy Garvey McMahon, your volunteer reader for SunSounds. Have a great week and enjoy your Thanksgiving weekend. Look forward to reading for you next time. Have Bye now.